On Super Bowl Sunday of 2003, my wife called out to me while I was upstairs watching their Simpsons television show while she had the downstairs TV tuned to the game. "Could you come down here, please?" she called out. "Great. Right in the middle of my program." I get grumpy when that happens. I could understand if it were a real emergency, such as if the kitchen had caught fire. But usually it turns out that she wants me to catch a tiny garden spider and put it outdoors or some such thing. "What do you want?" I called back. I was enjoying the show and I determined that I wasn't going to move. Besides, I didn't smell smoke, so it couldn't have been that important. "Just come down, please." "Sorry, no can do." "What do you want?" "I'm busy." She appeared at the door of the bedroom. "The cops are here." That got my attention. I jumped up, peered out through the drawn drapes and saw a cruiser with flashing emergency lights in my driveway. "You called the cops on me?" I asked. "Very funny. Just come down and see what they want," she said. It was a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy and he said that a witness had jotted down the license plate number of my vehicle and left it with a note on the windshield of a car in the local post office parking lot. The note claimed that I had scratched the other vehicle with my car. It was untrue, and I told the deputy so. Nevertheless, he threatened to charge me with hit and run if I didn't agree to pay for the alleged damages. He also claimed that he had inspected my vehicle in the driveway and found paint smudges and damage consistent with the violation he was alleging. I thought that was a pretty neat trick since it was dark out. This had gone far enough, I thought as I looked around vainly for some sign of Paul. It was indeed the last straw. I was the camel and my back was broken. No more, I thought. I desperately wanted to drop to my knees at that point and confess to Paul that he had made his point. I wanted to call off the experiment, willing to admit that my guardian angel is in fact impartantum vin in everyday matters not involving life and death. I don't like people coming into my house with guns. It makes me nervous. The first order of business was to do whatever was required to get this goon out of my house and off my back. The most serious trouble I ever had with the law was getting 2 or 3 traffic tickets in more than 50 years of driving. So I told the deputy that I would pay to have the other vehicle repaired. He was satisfied with that and he called the owner of the other car on his cell phone to tell her of my acquiescence. I had no intention of paying, of course. I figured that something didn't smell right. I suppose it's possible to scrape another vehicle with one's own and be unaware of it, but it just seemed a little too pat. I mean, what was the purpose of driving to my house with emergency lights flashing and then leaving them on in the driveway? What were the neighbors supposed to think? Unless he was investigating reports of gunshots and a corpse in the driveway, that were here heavy-handedness designed to intimidate, I thought. That belief was reinforced the next day when I inspected my pickup truck in full daylight, not with a flashlight in the dark, and found no such damage as he had claimed. My purpose of agreeing to pay was merely a ploy to get the cop out of my house. When the woman who owned the other vehicle called several days later to tell me that the damage would cost nearly $300 to repair, I relayed word to her that I would be turning the matter over to my insurance company rather than paying her personally. She thought that was a horrid idea and threatened to file a police report and charge me with hit and run if I didn't pay up. That made me even more suspicious because I had assumed a police report had already been filed. Otherwise, why would the sheriff's office be investigating? It sounded to me like collusion. She was using the same language employed by the deputy. I wasn't buying it, so I fired off another batch of pungent letters to the sheriff, the deputy's supervisor at the local station, and some politicians. After I voluntarily submitted my truck to the other car's insurance company for inspection and photographs, its agent said he could find no evidence of my involvement. My insurance company refused to pay, and I never heard another word from anyone about the incident. Well, just one, as well as the letter responses from the politicians. The deputy's captain called me and said that there must be some mistake. The deputy never claimed in his report that he had found evidence on my truck to support the charge. And, no, The deputy hadn't tried to intimidate me with the flashing lights, the threat to charge me with hit and run, the suggestion that I not involve my insurance company, and the offer to drop the matter if I paid up. Liars. Throughout February and the first 2 weeks of March, I felt like a wanderer lost in an equatorial swamp, constantly batting at swarms of insects that sought to dine on my blood. I was feeling the beady eyes of all manner of predator following my every stumbling move, looking for an opportunity to strike. By the middle of March, with 2 weeks still to go with my experiment, I was walking around in a perpetual sour state, which alternated with bouts of fury, frustration, and aggravation. If I were a superstitious person, I would have thought that I had been jinxed, that a hex had been cast upon me. It was as if everyone with whom I had dealings had decided in a moment of conspiratorial lunacy to not only abandon every sound principle of customer relations, but to take it to even further extremes by adopting attitudes of contempt toward the customer or client or citizen. Finally, I could take it no more. "Paul, I quit," I said aloud one morning around the middle of March. I was alone in my den/office after my wife had gone to work. I was openly calling upon him to show himself, along with some mercy, something I had never done. I had no idea if he would respond, but this constant aggravation was pushing me toward apoplexy. He materialized before my eyes, wearing, of all things, a long white robe that fell in loose folds to below his knees and covered his arms to his wrists, and a simple pair of sandals or shower clogs on his bare feet. Not surprisingly, he also was wearing a sanguine smile that I could easily have interpreted as self-satisfied if I had a suspicious nature. I was delighted to see him. "Well, did you learn anything?" he asked cheerily. Until this episode, I had always considered myself quite self-reliant, capable of getting nicely through life even without the necessity of a wife, if that waste be how things worked out. I hadn't been sure since the age of 15 that I ever would take a wife, or, more accurately, if a woman would ever take me as a husband. That was based upon a casual comment my mother made to me on a day when I suppose I was being particularly difficult. "I pity the poor woman who ever marries you, you rotten son of a bitch," she had spat out in a menopausal moment. A few months without Paul had made me realize that self-sufficiency is a relative term. It works well when we are in our comfort zones. They're insular little boxes that we inhabit, be it the kitchen, the workshop, the office, where we are in total control. But once we venture from those secure enclaves into the big world outside, no one is totally self-reliant. Almost with a hangdog expression, I admitted this to Paul and confessed that I hadn't realized just how vulnerable I would be in trying to get through the day without some backup. "Don't be so hard on yourself. Actually, you coped pretty well, all things considered," he said. "I'm glad somebody thought so. I thought I had done miserably. I wondered how my life would have been different if he had not gone on vacation. Was it just a random string of minor irritants that had been plaguing me for the last several months? Or was this the way life normally would play out if not for the interference run by our guardian angels? At what point and during what incidents would Paul have stepped in to smooth out some of the rough spots? Regardless, I am quite grateful that we humans are blessed to have these sentinels. The last few months were thorny, and it was difficult for me to conceive of going through every day of my life operating at such a high stress level. I couldn't imagine that Paul's intervention would be required in every instance. There must be some problems that people are required to handle on their own. So the experiment, although being terminated slightly short of the original goal, did yield some valuable information. Angels do have a meaningful influence in the everyday lives of their charges. They aren't there just during periods of crisis. Anyway, there was no need for me to feel that I lacked gumption for failing to see the experiment through, Paul said. If I hadn't sent out my SOS to him when I did, he would have contacted me because he had discovered something that required me to be notified. That helped to salve my bruised ego somewhat, but the fact remained that I did throw in the towel. However, this bit of information helped soften the blow. Now I turned my attention to what news he might have for me. If he was on the verge of contacting me, that could mean only one thing: something serious was in the air. and that was enough to get me psyched, my senses impulsively on full alert. Although I had managed to stay busy in retirement, nevertheless there are periods of boredom, and I usually welcome events that occasionally come along to spice things up. The thought that he might be offering me a chance to have a bit of stimulation, maybe even some element of danger, well, not too much, maybe just a tad, tickled my spine and titillated the imagination. What was he waiting for? I studied his face for some sign that might telegraph his thoughts, a look of worry, uneasiness, something, anything. All I saw was calm and composed pleasantness. Well, he would get to it when he was ready, and no amount of fretting on my part was going to speed things up. So I let myself relax, and I visibly sank a bit deeper into my chair in front of the computer screen. In his own good time he finally got around to it. "Don't do anything stupid in traffic," he said. That was it? What the hell kind of urgent business was that? I would bide my time to see where this might go.
"I try not to," I replied.
"Right. There's no doubt that you're a defensive driver. That's good. What I mean is that you should make a conscious effort every time you get behind the wheel to keep your mind on what you're doing, to stay alert."
"Okay.
Yes, I know, you always do almost. Everyone has attention lapses though. I just want you to be aware of that. You don't have to be any more cautious than you normally are, just eliminate the lapses when you are driving. If there are any, of course."
"Will do."
I was deliberately being brusque and condescending. "I don't want you to give the police any excuse to pull you over. Going broke from paying undeserved tickets would be one thing, but you might end up in jail, and that would be cause for concern," he said.
"What's this all about, then?"
I asked, my interest now beginning to stir. I was definitely disappointed to learn that no grand adventure awaited me, at least not yet, and that I wouldn't be slipping off to some exotic destination on a secret mission. He simply wanted to let me know that the deputy who had come to my house at the end of January was pretty sore with me. It appeared that my letters of accusation had the effect of putting some law enforcement officers in an uncomfortable position. It was possible, Paul said, that I could be singled out, kept under scrutiny for traffic violations, no matter how minor, to be ticketed. I had to admit that my old junker of a truck did stand out in my neighborhood, so it wouldn't be hard to spot. But I wasn't particularly worried, especially since I no longer had a daily commute. Most of my driving consists of running to the grocery store or the post office. Most of the time, my truck just sits in the driveway, sometimes a week or more at a time without moving. Heck, I probably rack up more miles on my daily walk than I do in my truck. What did I do to get them on my case like this? I didn't go looking for a fight, I just put up a fuss when I thought that I had been unjustly accused. When you complained to their superiors rather than roll over and meekly defer to them, they took it as a personal challenge to their authority. He told me to try to imagine the following scenario. A young woman parks her shiny new car, a cheap, low-end import, but new nevertheless, in the parking lot of a commercial center near my house, where I occasionally park when I go to the post office. My vehicle is neither shiny nor new. It is a 1982 Toyota pickup with nearly a quarter million miles on it. It has dents, dings, scrapes, a badly oxidized and splotchy paint job, a broken bumper, pitted windshield, a bit of rust, and leaky weather stripping around the doors and windows. The interior isn't in quite that good a shape. Somehow, the shiny car had acquired a scratch along the driver's side. On a day that I visit the post office, the woman decides that she wants to have the scratch removed. Because of the deductible, her insurance would not have covered the expense. She looks around and her eyes fall upon my pitiable heap. It stands out like a gravy stain on a silk tie. Surely it can't belong to anyone of consequence in this neighborhood. More than likely it is owned by one of the illegal immigrant workers who travel to the area daily to perform the menial jobs that keep the middle-class neighborhood fit and functioning. Probably a gardener. Most likely uninsured. She jots down the license plate number, taps a friend or lover or relative in the sheriff's department, and a deputy is dispatched to my house. Well,
Obviously, the house doesn't belong to a migrant worker. Still, anyone who drives such a piece of junk probably wouldn't be very savvy and should be easy to squeeze. I wasn't that squeezable. I put the heat on them and they got sore. If I began getting undeserved tickets, I wouldn't be the first person to be targeted by cops with a grudge. And on a more serious note, Paul reminded me, there have been cases where innocent people have been hauled off to jail, have been hurt while resisting arrest, and have died in custody under suspicious circumstances. It was good advice. I promised to be on my best behavior and to remain alert. One more thing, though, I said. Yes. Don't be a stranger. Observation by Paul: all mortals are stardust, an insignificant mass of atoms that comes together and develops awareness of itself. How sad that most people, those masses of stardust that have achieved consciousness, don't appreciate the miracle of that. The Cargo Cult. My adventures with Paul were magical, nothing short of miraculous, and I am so very grateful for having been given the privilege to meet him, to get to know him, to interact with him, to learn from him. I was sorry when the period of the dynamic relationship with him eventually returned to the more sedate stage that I presume is the normal status between most people and their guardian angels. At the same time, I realize how extraordinarily fortunate I am to have been granted the honor of contact. But after I had finished writing this diary about my adventures and read it over several times, it struck me as extremely odd that I could not remember one single time when Paul had mentioned the word God. It was not only odd, it was absolutely extraordinary. I looked through all of my notes, racked my memory, did a computer search for the word God several times. I wasn't precisely right. He had spoken the word on exactly two occasions that I could pinpoint, which still struck me as extraordinary considering the source. In addition, when he did use the word, it was almost in a generic sense, much as someone like myself might use it in general speech rather than reverentially or in a spiritual sense. In one instance, I quoted him in an observation at the end of chapter 6, and in the second instance he used the word in chapter 8 when talking about love. Aside from that, he had never broached the subject even obliquely, had never once alluded to a supreme deity, as far as I could recall. Once that realization got to bouncing around inside my head, along with the minimal mention of God, other questions and reservations began taking hold and sprouting. For instance, he never claimed to be a spiritual entity. I realized that might sound naive because a guardian angel is, by religious definition, a spirit. But I am exploring beyond the spiritual realm here. One could imagine a definition of guardian angel that is broader and encompasses more than a religious or spiritual characterization. After all, there is a group of crime fighters that use that very name, the guardian angels, and its members are quite mortal citizen volunteers. I'm sure that Paul must have known that I could naturally have assumed that he is a spiritual entity. But the fact remains that he never made such a claim, which would have been confirmation for me, and that leaves a gaping hole for me to at least raise the question. A previous incident, nearly a year after I had first met him on Easter Sunday of 1999, is what provisionally had led me to the conclusion that Paul was a divine entity. Someone whom I unequivocally admire and trust revealed Paul's special relationship with me. Although she didn't specifically state so, the information she provided seemed to imply that he was a representative of the God whom the majority of Americans worship. At least the implication seemed clear enough to me. Now that I have gone back to reread the incident as I chronicled it in my second book, the phrasing surely could have led me to no other conclusion. So what was I thinking during all that time that I was in close contact with Paul? How could I accept with apparent composure the seemingly miraculous events of his sudden appearances and disappearances, his ability to materialize as an apparently normal mortal visible to anyone or exclusively to me when he so desired, to dematerialize as an apparition visible only to me? How could I explain his evident intimate knowledge of details of my life going back to my earliest memories? Any normal person observing such events would have no option except to explain them as supernatural phenomena. So how could I accept these events, which were observable facts, and reconcile them with my own beliefs, or more accurately, disbeliefs? wouldn't I have to recognize that the very existence of Paul trumped my own convictions, that therefore I had no logical choice but to admit that my concepts were flawed, to stop denying that there really is a supernatural reality? What a bizarre term that is, supernatural reality. It has to be the mother of all oxymora. But I digress. To answer all of those questions in one fell swoop, let me just say that I was simply waiting. I remember some years ago seeing a TV program about a tribe of primitive people, perhaps in New Guinea, who had lived in long isolation from the modern world. One day civilization came marching in with the construction of a modern airport large enough to accommodate jetliners carrying passengers and cargo. Hundreds of the primitive people on a daily basis pressed their faces to the wire fence surrounding the facility and watched in total open-mouth astonishment as the giant silver birds appeared from the heavens. These semi-naked people, still living in much the same fashion as their prehistoric ancestors had for thousands of years, were quite simply thunderstruck. There was only one plausible explanation. The silver birds were instruments of the gods. The people they disgorged were messengers of the gods, demigods themselves, possibly, and the cargo was the riches of heaven sent for the benefit of a chosen people. No other explanation was possible. I am told that the incident, actually a series of incidents in several locations, later became known to anthropologists as the cargo cult. To cash in on this bonanza, the natives used sticks and other crude implements to scratch out of the barren earth their own version of a runway, complete with a makeshift control tower inelegantly fashioned from whatever branches the jungle might yield. It was their intention to lure the silver birds to alight at their own reception area and to claim their rightful share of the gifts from the gods. I know it's hard to believe, but nary a one of those heavenly silver birds ever touched down on the natives' landing strip. My situation with Paul was not unlike that of these jungle inhabitants with their spellbound faces pressed raptly against the fence. There was one minor difference: I could understand the arrival and the departure of the silver birds without superstitiously grasping for a supernatural explanation. The natives did not have that advantage because they had been born into a totally alien world from the one I inhabited. I was exposed to a world of science and technology. They had no modern technology or science. While I, too, pressed my face in awe and wonder against my own metaphorical chain-link fence as the adventure with Paul unfolded before me, I was far better equipped. Thanks to an accident of birth that plopped me down in America, I had the ability to consider a number of options to explain the experience without jumping to the conclusion that it had to have a magical or supernatural base. So back to the question of what I was thinking during my time with Paul. The answer is, nothing. I was reserving judgment. I was waiting, neither denying nor accepting the premise that he was a spiritual being waiting to be convinced or persuaded one way or the other. To believe that he is a divine entity without any evidence or proof to support that conviction requires a leap of faith that my brain is incapable of making. When it comes to faith versus science, it is in my very nature to come down on the side of the latter. I require evidence. That's just who I am. Well, what other explanation could there be? My primitive brain might ask. I don't know. I have plenty of other questions, but I have no answers. But let us suppose for a few moments. Let us imagine that countless other planets in the universe are inhabited by intelligent beings. Let us also assume that some portion of those inhabitants have created civilizations and that some portion of those civilizations are far ahead of the human species scientifically and technologically. Let us further assume that some of those advanced beings are space travelers capable of traveling to other worlds. Thousands of people have offered personal testimony over decades that they have witnessed or experienced a variety of contact experiences with extraterrestrial intelligence. In addition, there is hardcore belief among various groups and individuals that this government, and perhaps others, are secretly in possession of rather large amounts of evidence that would support claims of extraterrestrial, human contacts. They also believe that other evidence exists in the public domain that scientists refuse to study for political reasons. Although I am not of that opinion personally, I mention it as a counterbalance to my own beliefs. I personally know of no hard scientific evidence to support the testimony of those who claim extraterrestrial contact or even to assume as yet that such life does indeed exist. Yet despite what I consider to be a lack of scientific data, I am a firm believer in the existence of extraterrestrial intelligent life. Some may characterize that belief as faith, but my convictions are not faith-based, they are more substantial than that. One does not require a leap of faith to imagine it. If such life does exist elsewhere, it would be in the natural order of things, quite in line with the laws of the cosmos as we thus far know them. A supernatural explanation would not be necessary. Now let us presuppose that the inhabitants of some of those civilized and technologically advanced planets have evolved into creatures with a highly developed moral, ethical, altruistic sense, beings whose very nature is gentle, kindly, compassionate and, most of all, benevolent. It is not illogical, perhaps a bit far-fetched, but not impossible to imagine that one of those space-faring species could have stumbled upon our tiny little corner of the universe in its travels. Some religious orders on Earth send out missionaries to tend to the needs of the less fortunate scattered in countries around the globe, as well as to seek converts to their own religious beliefs. The governments of many developed nations also have programs designed to give aid and comfort to needy nations. Private secular groups as well are actively working to alleviate human suffering and improve lives of wretchedness. If I really let my imagination loose, I can visualize a race of extraterrestrial space travelers whose technologically advanced civilizations provide for every need of its citizens to live long lives of comfort and contentment. But perhaps somehow that is not enough to satisfy deeper yearnings. I'm not knocking luxury, something that probably most humans would cherish. But suppose there is still an inner emptiness that mere physical comfort and wealth cannot fill, a driving need to find some greater purpose in their lives. Imagine that these millions, or billions, of individuals discovered that they could fill that internal emptiness through genuine service to others, that their lives would have greater meaning if, instead of going monotonously through endless hedonistic days of self-indulgence, they dedicated themselves to trying to help others who are in need. So this is one of the many places where my imagination could lead me, a race of guardian angels whose individual members devote themselves to the benefit of other sentient beings. No other reward other than a sense of satisfaction is sought. I can imagine Paul being one of those selfless individuals. Of course, I would have to assume that the members of that species have mastered the art and science of communication by telepathy, the ability to become visible and invisible at will, a facility to probe the thoughts, perhaps even the memories, of those over whom they stand watch. But, of course, that's all speculation. I just wanted to present at least one plausible natural alternative to explain Paul's presence as a counterpoint to those who might consider me astoundingly naive, even stunningly simple-minded not to have immediately embraced the undeniable truth of Paul's supernatural pedigree. And I'm sure there are many other possible explanations that wouldn't have to wander into the arena of the supernatural. But since Paul did not provide me with a curriculum vitae, I can only speculate on his origins and background. But even with the presence of protectors, there still exists much wretchedness and injustice in the world. So why are some people more fortunate than others? Why was I chosen to meet my benefactor while billions of others never get that opportunity? Because life is not fair. Other than that, I just do not know. While writing these words, a long distant memory suddenly and inexplicably popped into my head. I hadn't forgotten about the incident, but it had been lying dormant. This was the first time that it had come into view in several decades. For a period of a few months in the army, while I was waiting an assignment to a kitchen after completing cook school, I served temporarily as a driver. I was dispatched one day to the site of a field exercise to pick up three soldiers and transport them in the jeep to headquarters. It was a routine assignment as far as I was concerned. I had no idea what the three were frantically discussing in Spanish as I made the delivery. Only later did I learn that the body of another soldier had been found some hours earlier, beaten and stabbed to death. Apparently he had been bushwhacked as he walked from the soldiers' club back to his barracks the night before. While the troops were in the field on their training exercises that bright morning, an inspection of every troop's locker was conducted base-wide. This search yielded bloody clothing from the lockers of the three recruits who were in my jeep. They were murder suspects, and yet no hint of that status was given to me when I resaved the assignment. When I found out about it later, I was really annoyed.